This is World Radio, KHOE 90.5 FM, and this is the program Chat with the Dean, a new interview program highlighting the faculty at MUM and visiting faculty and lecturers. Your host is Dr. Kathy Greeny, Dean of Faculty at MUM. Welcome, Dr. Greeny. Who is your guest today?
Today we have Dr. Rhoda Orme Johnson with us. She was a founding faculty member of MIU, and she will be talking today about a new book she has edited called The Flow of Consciousness. It's a book of transcripts of Maharshi's lectures. So first I'd like to just say a few words about Rhoda. When I first came to MIU in 1978, she was one of the first people I met, and I was just so inspired. I thought, this is the place I want to be if there's people like this here. She has a BA in mathematics from Vassar College, and an MA and PhD in comparative literature from the University of Maryland. So the first thing I'd like to ask you is, how did you go from mathematics to literature?
Well, my father made me major in mathematics because he thought it was practical. He didn't realize that to get a job in mathematics, you had to have a PhD in mathematics. So I did major in it. But literature was always my first love, and in every moment I had, I was reading a novel and taking courses in the Russian novel and always doing that. But I did graduate in mathematics, and I became a computer programmer at a company called Bellcom in Washington, D.C. We were programming the abort trajectories for the Apollo project. And at night I began taking novel courses at the University of Maryland for fun. And the professor teaching some of these courses twisted my arm, gave me an assistantship, admitted me to the program without an application, and there I was, launched on my academic career in comparative literature.
Well, that was very fortunate for MIU, now MUM. As a founding faculty member of MIU, what was your experience in, you know, developing a curriculum that related literature to the science of creative intelligence?
Well, it was a great challenge to all of us, and so Maharshi guided us, because we didn't exactly, we knew we were meditating, that was good, and we were evolving, that was very good, but literature seemed to be about all kinds of different things. So in those early days, the faculty would present a talk on their discipline, art, literature, music, and then Maharshi would comment. He would give a talk in response. So that kind of talk is in the book. And then he would have, at symposia, scholars would talk about their specialty. It could be poetry, it could be literature. And then he would follow that with a talk connecting it with SCI. Or, when we were with him in Switzerland for 4 years, frequently some visiting professor, a professor would drop by, like Professor Erica Lorenz from Germany, or Professor Peter Malikin from England, and they would give a presentation, and then Maharshi would comment on it. So those are the lectures that I have transcribed for this book.
Before I ask you some questions about the book, I want to know, how did your understanding of literature change from these interactions with Maharshi?
Well, it went from just sort of, I have to say, pure mindless enjoyment to a realization that the reason that literature was so charming to me is it because it was affecting my consciousness, not just self-knowledge. You know, you read a novel, you read about a character, and you go, oh, that's kind of like me. I could be like that. I shouldn't be like that, you know, or maybe I should be like that. So there was that kind of knowledge, that self-knowledge that always came from literature. But I was really, I think, pretty unaware of how rhythm and sound and meaning and silences in the literature were affecting my consciousness, the consciousness of the reader, and actually molding the consciousness of the reader. So I realized from Maharshi's insights that there was a lot going on to the whole creation and enjoyment of literature that was very evolutionary. In fact, he said that the study of literature can even evolve you to unity consciousness.
So I want to hear more about what is in this book. Can you tell us what topics or what themes or what kinds of lectures there are in the book and some of your favorite points of what Maharshi brings out about literature?
Okay, but you may not get to put another word in.
That's fine with me.
Okay, well, I had to write an introduction because who is Maharshi? And where did these tapes come from? So I wrote an introduction to the volume, Maharshi Mahesh Yogi and His Worldwide Transcendental Meditation Movement. And it's kind of my personal experience of Maharshi as I came to know him over the years and appreciate his great wisdom and his ability to add an angle and insights to any field of study. It's incredible. He could hear someone talk on nuclear physics or biology or this, and he'd get right to the heart of the matter, right to the heart of the matter. It was so inspiring. And then I selected 14 lectures that we used to play for the students in order to illuminate our teaching in our classes and their view of literature and language into two sections, 7 on literature, 7 on language. So then I wrote an introduction to the literature section called Literature, The Ocean in a Drop, kind of summarizing Maharshi's points, and I can talk more about that. And then my colleague, Susan Anderson, wrote an introduction to the language section. So let me just briefly tell you what's in those sections. I organize them kind of by ease. So I start out with the most basic lecture. So if you're new to TM, if you don't know anything about SCI or Science and Technology of Consciousness, doesn't matter. You read the first talks and your knowledge grows. And by the time you get to the last one, you have quite a sophisticated knowledge, and the tape is quite sophisticated, has some very sophisticated things in it. So the literature section begins with a talk in response to one given by former Professor Cy Migdal called Literature, The Link Between Objective Reality and Universality. And that's followed by a talk on creativity and suffering. It was brought up at a conference that many artists had suffered. Is it necessary to be a suffering artist in order to write great literature or produce great art? No, 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 says Maharshi. Very interesting talk. The Nature of Learning and the Progress of Knowledge follows that. That is a marvelous talk on how we learn, how knowledge is presented to us, how we learn, what are the ways in which our consciousness is affected by the whole educational process. Every teacher should read this. Every student should appreciate what's going on. Then the next tape is called The Quantum Theory of Literature, because obviously consciousness and literature are based on the most abstract levels of consciousness, so we need a quantum theory of literature. This was a talk with Peter Malakin, professor from England, who visited Maharshi and said, Maharshi, what I want is a quantum theory of literature. And a brilliant conversation follows from that. Then we have 3 lectures on poetry in the Veda, where Maharshi says, but the best poetry is the poetry of the Veda. Because in the Veda, the sound and the meaning, the name and the form, go hand in hand, and they really affect consciousness. So those get very abstract and very interesting, those talks. Then the language section, again, begins with an introduction, language expressing the full range of life, in which Susan sums up Maharshi's points, and begins with a very basic talk, Principles of Communication, that which he did in Switzerland. And then enlivening consciousness, the common basis of all languages, the ground for perfect communication. Then a talk, an interesting talk, on language and climate. Why are there different languages? How does climate and geography affect the growth of a language, the meaning of a language? And what does it do to our brain to speak in a foreign language, for example? Then radiating waves of happiness, communicating supreme knowledge to everyone, marvelous tape on how it is a basic human nature to share. We want to share what we know, and we want to share it with everyone. So, of course, Maharshi makes us into a talk on how we can share the knowledge of TM and Science of Creative Intelligence with everyone, but how we want to share knowledge. Then the next few tapes, again, get very abstract. The relation between name and form in the Veda, and that level of consciousness that knows all and sees all, Ritam Bara Pragya. And then the phenology of creation, we have name and form, then we know at the very basic level of creation, consciousness comes out giving a name. That name is also the form, and the two grow up like twins, he says, name and form together until both manifest. And then the last talk is on the root bu and Vedic grammar. Again, a beautiful talk on grammar and the Veda and consciousness. So, and I called the book The Flow of Consciousness because Maharishi says, when we know literature to be the flow of consciousness, the flow of life, the flow of nature, the flow of infinity, totality, then we have to study it on the ground of that infinite, unbounded, total value of consciousness.
Beautiful. I'd really like you to elaborate on this point about artists and suffering, because this, you know, we hear all the time, oh, artists should suffer. And then what does that have to do with the person who reads literature or views art? You know, what is their role in this from the point of view of suffering also?
Well, nobody likes to suffer, Maharishi points out. Unfortunately, there is a lot of suffering in the world. But suffering is not a prerequisite for producing or creating art or literature. Say the artist is suffering, Maharishi says. His life is full of suffering. What happens is he turns to create something, and the creative process creates some joy, some relief from suffering, and he goes that way. So he pours himself into his art because it's a relief from suffering. It's a vacation from suffering. Now, the subject matter may be about the suffering or other aspects of his life, but the actual creation is coming out of joy. The suffering is not necessary to the creation. It just can be there, but it's not the reason for the creation, and it's not the source or cause of it. Similarly, for the reader, the reader can read about suffering. You can read about a novel, for example, in which people have to go through terrible things. This is life. Stuff happens. But when the reader is grounded in their own consciousness, what do they see? They see the play of nature. They see cause and effect. They see what's going on in creation. Let me read you another quote that kind of gives the angle on that. So even the study of literature that could have some suffering in it can be an enjoyable process. Say you read about a character who's suffering, and well, then maybe you don't have to go through that. And maybe it sheds some knowledge on your own life and times, and you can grow from that. But he says, no matter what one sees, that's if you've got TM program in your life and your mind is slippery and you give it a chance, it slips right down into unbounded pure consciousness, then no matter what one sees evolution there. And because evolution is one's own nature, one sees one's own nature in everything. And this reference to the self makes everything enjoyable. So the study of literature would even go so far as to develop unity consciousness.
That is really quite amazing. Sometimes you read something, at least I do, and I feel like, gee, the writer really must have some deeper awareness or some deeper level of consciousness. And you know, of course, I feel like when I recognize that in something I've read, I think, oh, well, you know, I'm recognizing that because of what I know from Maharishi and what I know of higher states of consciousness. Now, can you tell if a writer has some higher value of consciousness? And when you read it, can it help you in any way evolve to a higher state of consciousness?
Yes, I think both of those things. Can you tell what state of consciousness a writer is in? No, you you can't always, but the writer, by describing certain experiences that you recognize, you then have to think, well, the writer may not be in that state of consciousness, but they have experienced that state of, however briefly, they have experienced that state of consciousness. And Maharishi points out that it's very important for the writer. The writer is going to be a better writer if he or she operates from that field of silence. And he says, and the deeper the silence that the writer has, then the greater the comprehension, the bigger the range of influence, and the more compact, the more sweet, more exact, more apt the poetry will be. And he says that all the elements that distinguish the work of art depend upon how deep the silence is in his heart, in his mind. So a good living poetry is the expression of living deep silence, is the breath of silence, so to speak. The breath of cosmic life rises in that individual comprehension and bursts into speech, and then it flows from line to line, from line to line. So the writer's consciousness is, you know, if it's pure, then out comes spontaneously, effortlessly, something marvelous. He says the purity of the writer is the thing. The purity of the writer, in the purity of the consciousness of the writer, who is able to bring in an ocean in a drop, you know, to see, have a widely comprehensive vision, in just a little detail, to see the ocean in a drop, that microscopic vision, that microscopic appreciation, which naturally comprehends the totality on any surface value of a thing. And that's from poetry in the Veda. Those quotes are from poetry in the Veda.
I love this phrase, the ocean in a drop. Do you have any examples of poems that you could show us how the poet expresses the ocean in a drop?
Yes. Let me read you one. This is, and this also will illustrate a point I'm going to make in a minute, too, on how, Maharishi says, how literature affects your consciousness. It swings your awareness from concrete to abstract and purifies consciousness in the doing of that. But here's a little poem that kind of does that. This is called This Clay Jug, and it's by Kabir. He says, inside this clay jug, there are canyons and pine mountains, and the maker of canyons and pine mountains. All seven oceans are inside, and hundreds of millions of stars. The acid that tests gold is there, and the one who judges jewels, and the music from the strings no one touches, and the source of all water. If you want the truth, I will tell you the truth. Friend, listen. The God whom I love is inside. So we start out this clay jug. Well, you might think, okay, here's this little clay jug sitting on the table. But here's a different clay jug inside. This body, you know, we talk about being made of clay. This body, in this clay jug, the body, there are canyons and pine mountains, and the maker of canyons and pine mountains. So he's taking us from this clay jug to, woo, the maker, pine mountains, canyons, the clay jug, pine mountains, concrete, abstract, swinging the awareness between them like that. So it works the awareness, and it shows that that Kabir had some expanded consciousness, because he was seeing in the body, in the human consciousness, the whole creation. He was seeing infinity in that point. He was seeing the whole ocean in that drop. We are that drop, and we are also the whole ocean. So yes, that's one way. And Blake said the same thing. He said you could see infinity in an ocean, infinity in a grain of sand. If you have the vision. If you have the vision, you can see that. So it's necessary for the reader, in order to really enjoy literature and understand it, the reader has to get him or herself on that level of the poet, I mean, the reader can't be lagging behind or the reader is not going to get it. And I'm sure you were all in class sometime in your life and you would study some work of literature and someone would raise their hand and say, I don't get it. I don't understand it. Well, okay, you know, get it together and get your consciousness someplace good and then you will get it. My husband used to say when he started meditating, he had never been able to follow E.E. Cummings, and he started meditating, and then he could just pick it up and read it. It was such a joy. Let me read you this poem by Juan Ramon Jimenez, a contemporary Hispanic poet. And it's a wonderful poem, and it has great meaning, but what does it mean to someone who doesn't know what pure consciousness is, or to someone who doesn't know... Well, let me read the poem. I am not I. I am this one who goes by my side, unseen by me, whom I at times go visit, and whom I at times forget. He who keeps silent, serene, when I speak. He who forgives, sweet, when I hate. He who takes a walk where I am not. He who will remain standing when I die. So we have to say Jimenez had some nicely evolved consciousness there. This, we could say, is about witnessing. Now, we know that after some time of practice of transcendental meditation, experiencing unbounded awareness, then that unbounded awareness starts to be the background of what we are experiencing. It becomes the kind of color or the glass through which we see. So his poem seems to be about that. Who is this by my side? Who goes by my side unseen? It's myself, right by my side with me. And I am not I. I'm not this little I. That's not me. I'm not that. I am this one, this unbounded one who quietly walks by my side. He who will remain standing when I, this little body, this clay jug, is finished. So what does this mean to someone who doesn't know what pure consciousness is, what witnessing is? What does it mean to them? So the reader has to, it behooves the reader to develop his or her consciousness in order to get it. And here's even a passage from Thoreau on witnessing. And what will it mean to someone who doesn't know? Thoreau says in Walden, I only know myself as a human entity, the scene, so to speak, of thoughts and affections, and am sensible of a certain doubleness by which I can stand as remote from myself as from another. However intense my experience, I am conscious of the presence and criticism of a part of me, which, as it were, is not a part of me, but spectator, sharing no experience, but taking note of it, and that is no more I than it is you, because it's so universal, huh? When this play of life is over, the spectator goes his way. It was a kind of fiction, a work of the imagination only, as far as he was concerned. So you're reading Thoreau and you read this and you think, what is he talking about? What is this? But if you know what witnessing is, you appreciate that Thoreau had these kinds of experiences. So was he in cosmic consciousness? Probably not. But was he having experiences or glimpse of it? Probably he was. Probably he was.
So there must have been a period in your life when you had been appreciating novels, and with a PhD in comparative literature, you were obviously reading very deeply and thinking very deeply. But there must have been a time when you started learning about higher states of consciousness, learning about absolute and relative, and there must have been a time when you started realizing that great writers were talking about that. Could you talk about that discovery of your own?
Well, as I remember sitting with Marishi at Humboldt. That was our SCI course, was in Humboldt in the early 70s. And David presented a talk on his research, my husband, so we were sitting up front with the SRM folks right up front. And Marishi was talking about things I had never heard of. He was talking about God at the time. I was an atheist. And you know, David and I would look at each other like, what is he saying? Well, I don't know, but we wrote it down. We wrote it down. And the thing about it is, the more experience you have, we went off then to found MIU, with teacher training, be with Marshy, is that you listen, you begin to understand, you begin to have these experiences, and without your being consciously aware of it, they begin to inform your perception. I once had some students who were taking a class in playwriting, and they said, do we have to write about SEI? And I said, no, you don't. Their plays were full of it. They didn't realize, but that was the glass through which they saw everything. And so how could they write about human life and not write about consciousness and not write about evolution? Wasn't possible. So that's what happened, is just I began to see everything in terms of evolution, in terms of consciousness. Can't help it. And so from that time on, when I pick up something, I was looking for literature. What was I going to write my PhD on? You know, I was reading, looking, and I could see the play of nature, the play of the laws of nature, the episodic moments of higher states of consciousness in everything I read. It was so obvious. I was like, where was I before? It was like I woke up, you know, and I had been asleep before. So I had to play these tapes for the students, and what happened with them is, as they were immersed in the knowledge, in Marishi's knowledge, in the knowledge in the classroom, in their own programs, it informed their consciousness. It informed their perception. They became ideal readers of literature.
Thank you. That was beautiful. What was your dissertation on, if I may ask?
Oh, my dissertation.
Where you found higher states of consciousness where you had not imagined anything like that before?
Yes. Well, let me explain that. Okay, I wrote on a myth called the Cupid and Psyche myth. The story, the myth, appears in a 2nd century novel by the Roman writer Apuleius. And he's telling the story of this young man who's looking for knowledge, looking for wisdom. He thinks he'll find it in witchcraft or in some kind of occult study. And he gets himself into deep water. And while he's in trouble, he actually gets involved with some witches, and he gets turned into a donkey. And then he gets ridden as a donkey and locked up as a donkey. He's in a terrible state. But while he's a donkey, this old woman tells a story to a young girl who's been captured by these same bandits and is crying. She says, I'll tell you a story. And she tells the story of Cupid and Psyche. Well, Cupid and Psyche is a story about Cupid, the god of love, Amor, and how he, and Psyche means the human soul. So it's a story, Psyche falls in love with Cupid, he leaves her, she follows him, she finds him, she has to go down to the underworld to get, to find out from the gods of the underworld how she can get him back, and it's a little myth there. Well, it doesn't sound like anything very useful, but if you realize that if you can see the descent into the underworld that Psyche, the soul, takes is a descent into the self, and that the knowledge that Psyche gets down there, deep down there in the dark in the underworld meeting with the gods, when she comes out, you know, then she finds Cupid and she's reunited, and the soul and love marry, they become one. So that's called archetypal criticism, where you look at a plot pattern or as an archetype of consciousness. So Lucius, now the donkey, hears this story, and he figures out how to get himself out of trouble. He prays to the gods, and they show him, and he gets back his human form. They tell him what to do, and gets back his human form. But that archetypal journey of going into the self, which is what he has to do, he has to make that same trip. So then I found 6 different novels, American, German, French, that played on this Cupid and Psyche myth. And what I showed was that moment in the novel where Psyche, the soul, would go down into the underworld was described by the writer as an inner journey into consciousness in some way. So the writer, as a reader, understood that when Psyche descends into the underworld, it's actually the soul going down into the depths of pure consciousness, into the self. That's how they responded to it, and that's how they wrote about it. So they were getting that archetype. So that's my dissertation. It's in the library. You could read it. It's very long. But so I saw it in that myth.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw that Apuleius also saw it. And Lucius, the donkey, saw it. And so did all these novelists who wrote on that myth. They saw it too.
And how did your faculty understand it? Did they appreciate what you were doing?
My dissertation committee was rather wowed, I must say, but they got it, and they passed me on the first go, and it was quite remarkable. But they got it, and the interesting thing was when I finished the whole thing, and I said to Marcia, "I'm going now to defend my dissertation," because I'd written it all, and he said, "Oh, tell them." And he told me a paragraph or two about what literature is all about, how it's all about consciousness and everything. He said, "Tell them that." I said, "Okay." So I put it in the dissertation, the last couple paragraphs. I just put it right in there. And then when they read it, they went, "No, this here, at the end here, now this, you're actually proposing a new theory of literature." I said, "Yes, yes." They picked it up immediately. But that was different. It's, you know.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Last couple of paragraphs, you can look that up. Straight from Marishi. So, when I was teaching, then playing these tapes, you know, was a no-brainer. I mean, you had to know these things, you know, as a student.
Oh, absolutely.
And you need to know these things as a reader, as a critic, which is where the book could be helpful to you. I mean, not just Marishi does say over and over again, should go learn TM, you know, and all that. That's an obvious lesson. But from his insights into how literature works, this could inform your writing, could inform your reading, could inform your teaching, how you teach. Because Marishi says literature can create unity consciousness. How? See? So I can talk about that too.
Yeah. Well, I do want to hear more about what the reader can get from your book, but I want to know what you gained most by transcribing these lectures and choosing which ones would go in the book and preparing it for the reader.
Well, a couple things. One was transcribing these lectures, sitting there listening to Marishi and transcribing, you know, you write it down over and over again. It was like being with him. It was like sitting at his knee. And when and I put them in his language, I didn't edit it out to sound like a lecture. I'm like a something written. I left in the repetition. I left in his phrasing. I just paragraphed and put in a few periods here and there and some commas. I wanted to leave the flavor of Marishi so you, the reader, could sit with him and sit at his knee and hear him talk. And I suggest that that's how you read it, that you kind of listen to these talks. So they worked me.
Well, can I just interject something here? I did have a chance to read some of this, and I did feel like I could hear Maharishi's voice, and I did feel the rhythm was there, and I did feel like I was getting it straight from Maharishi.
Yeah, that's right. That's the experience. And so it was a really transformative thing. And then to write that introduction I mentioned, where I summarized all of his ideas, to pour over these talks and extract the principles, well, that was an education right there. That informed my teaching, my writing, because I my understanding of other people's writing. So yes, it was completely a transformative experience. The best thing I could have done for myself. And he encouraged me I proposed this project to him, and he said, "Oh yes, yes, do it." Encouraged me, even sent me a tape that we didn't have in our library at a time when no tapes were coming from the International Tape Library. I got one, which really wowed the faculty. They were very impressed with me. "How did you do that? How did you get that tape?"
So what do you think the reader will get from this book?
I think the reader, hearing Marishi's words, it'll be like sitting with him. That will get that the benefits of being in Marishi's presence. We call that darshan. Some consciousness is going to be transferred from Marishi to the reader. And then if the reader sees what Marishi's saying, then when the reader goes to read something, the reader's reading is going to be informed. For example, Maharishi says, I mentioned the swings between concrete and abstract. He says that the swinging the awareness from concrete to abstract, he says, of giving jerks and jolts to the awareness and to the emotions is a process of purification. It's a process of purification, he says. All that is unwanted filters out. All that is life-supporting remains, adhering to one's consciousness. This is the purifying value of the process of gaining knowledge, of study. That's what it is. Let me just illustrate that. Okay, here's a little poem by James Wright, and it's called Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. The poem is hardly as long as the title, but that's the title. Okay. Over my head, I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. A chicken hawk floats over, looking for home. I have wasted my life. So that last line, I have wasted my life. Now, it's a shocker. It's a shocker. Has he wasted his life? What is he saying? What does he mean? I'm not going to tell you. You figure it out. But did you have the thought, have I wasted my life? Huh? Did you have some self-referral there? Have I wasted my life? You can't help thinking that. You can't help thinking that. So here's this little jerk. See, he's really given you the hook, and you took that hook deep, and then he goes, jerk. And what does it do? Create self-referral. Ah, it's beautiful.
That is amazing. Let me remind you, we're here with Rhoda Orme Johnson, founding faculty of MIU and editor of the book, The Flow of Consciousness, Lectures by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. When will this book be available, and will you be here to sign copies for people?
It's at the bindery now as we record this tape. It should be back on Monday, November 1st. And I will probably be doing some signings over the weekend, probably something on the first Friday, November 5th, Art Walk. I don't know where yet. There will probably be a poster. Just keep an eye out. Maybe something in the Fairfield Weekly Reader if I can get organized. Probably at the MUM bookstore over the weekend. So just keep an eye out. I think there will be something, and it should be announced. There will be also an article in Jim Carpin's, that thing that comes out on
the MUM review.
Yeah. Coming out on next Tuesday, there's going to be an article on this, too.
Beautiful, yes. Beautiful. Mm. Do you have any parting words or
Well, I would like to read you one more poem. I can't.
Please,
I
please.
Can't help myself here. I have to read this poem. It's a favorite of mine. It's by Emily Dickinson, and the reason I like it is because it swings the awareness from concrete to abstract, which we now see everywhere. And also, well, I'll read it, and we'll see what you think. It's called My Period Had Come for Prayer. My period had come for prayer. No other art would do. My tactics lacked a rudiment. Creator, was it you? God grows above, so those who pray, horizons must ascend. And so I stepped upon the north to see this curious friend. His house was not, no sign had he. By chimney nor by door could I infer his residence. Vast prairies of air, unbroken by a settler, were all that I could see. Infinitude, hadst thou no face that I might look on thee? The silence condescended. Creation stopped for me. But awed beyond my errand, I worshipped, did not pray. So, it's hard to talk after that, isn't it? Okay, so look at that. Where does God live? Vast prairies of air, very expansive, very broad. Follows by chimney, nor by door. How specific can you be? Looking for God, there's no house, there's no chimney, there's no door. But where's his residence? Vast prairies of air. There the consciousness is swung from concrete to abstract. And these vast prairies of air are unbroken by a settler. K-k-t-t. Okay? There's the chop-chop, the g-g-g-g, breaking up that vast prairies of air, that ah, right? So there's the poem doing that for you. Infinitude, hadst thou no face. Now, the silence condescended. Marvelous word. Condescended. Descended is in there. Descended. Stepping down the steps. Condescended. The silence walked down the steps. My consciousness walked down the steps. And what happens there at the bottom? Creation stopped. For me. And awed beyond my errand. You know, when you're in that, you don't say, and I would like a Porsche, and I would like an income of it, and I would, you know, you can't pray. You can only worship. You can only worship. So the poem, in its rhythms, in its vowels, in its consonants, in its language, in its selection of words, in its structure, creates that experience in the reader of transcending. Now, maybe not to the transcendent, because eyes are open, hands are holding a piece of paper, but it creates something in that direction. And if one is used to transcending, as I said, if the mind is slippery, used to transcending, it does. It just transcends, goes right along with it to that at the end. You can't help but be drawn into it. So that's just another of my favorite little poems, and so it's a joy actually to find these things and to see them. For example, as a poet, Wallace Stevens, he was a brilliant guy, probably enlightened. I really think he probably was enlightened. He worked as an insurance agent in Hartford, Connecticut, and he wrote poems on the side, and they puzzle critics. They absolutely puzzle critics. But when you read them with an eye, broadened by the knowledge of consciousness, of Maharishi's knowledge, you see what he's talking about. He says, the river of rivers runs through Connecticut. what is that? It's not some, you know, river. It's the river of rivers runs through Connecticut. So like that. It, you know, it opens the eye. It opens the eye to have this knowledge. And that's what I think it will do for the reader. Open the eye.
So thank you so much, Rhoda, for talking about this book and sharing these insights with us. I'm just wondering, you haven't been teaching for some time, but does your legacy go on? Are some of your students involved in literature and writing and reading these days?
Well, one you may know is Ninka. Ninka was one of my literature students. I remember when she came from Holland at the age of 17 or 18, and I first met her in a Forest Academy block. Now she's this beautiful, mature woman with writes fantastic poetry and is a beloved and great teacher. It's I look back at my students. I run into them all the time. They come up to me on courses, and they look at me, and I say their name, and they go, "Oh, you remember me." And I sometimes get one that wants to friend me on Facebook or LinkedIn or one of those other social network things. And we chat back and forth for a couple times. And they tell me what they're doing, they're writing, they're teaching, they're involved in literature and writing somewhere, you know. So, yes, I do hear from them, and I really enjoy it. I always enjoy seeing them. And it was a great time. I loved my students. And I saw them as, you know, as my own children. And one of them was worried because she thought she She was unstressing so much that she would put her head down on the desk, and she was so embarrassed. And I said, okay, who cares? I didn't mind. So it was wonderful having students. I enjoyed it. But I'm focusing in these days in my life and my own evolution, my own enlightenment. We just spent 5 months on the IA course. That seems to be a good direction. And I'm writing my memoirs. I've had an interesting life, spent a lot of time with Maharishi, and it's kind of a form of self-knowledge to write who you are. I may never publish, but I'm certainly enjoying the process. And so who knows what will come of that. And I do write poetry. I could do a poetry reading sometime. My own poetry is very personal. It's about love and death and a lot of deaths, you know. But there's the transcendence in there. So, you know, I could do that. But who knows? Who knows? I'm only 70. I've got another, you know, 30, 40 years. I could do a lot of stuff.
Thank you so much. And I'm sure you will do a lot more. And as we know, every step gets better and better. Maharishi explains so much how everything we do is bigger than what we've done before. So it's very, very inspiring to think that someday we may get to see your memoirs.
Well, I say this is my only book. And everybody goes, oh, no, 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 it's your first book. I don't know. Maybe my only book.
No, it gets in your blood. So we have been discussing with Dr. Rhoda Orme Johnson her new book, The Flow of Consciousness, Lectures by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi on Literature and Language. This book will be out next week. I'd like to thank you for joining us today. My name is Kathy Guarini. Please join us again on the KHOE program, A Chat with the Dean.